The latest from Kim Gordon, wrapping up hour one of Headwaters today here on 91.7 KXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, at 89.9 in Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. After her last album got real wild, real gnarly, very like electronic, seems like a little bit of a return to almost getting some Sonic Youth, her old band vibes on that new single. The full album is coming out in March. Replacements before that, Can't Hardly Wait. I did hear that maybe no one was answering our slice of green cheese because it was so obvious, because everyone knew it and they thought someone would beat them to it. So I take back anything I said about you all. I love you. Coming up, there's another hour of Headwaters, including a conversation with Mary Lucia, a younger sister of Paul Westerberg and a wonderful radio DJ in her own right, along with an author of a great new novel that is kind of a harrowing and hard to read, not hard to read at times, like you can really power through it, but incredibly stressful and going into what that does to your life. I really like the title. I feel like at some point in the last few years, people have been like, trauma is bad. Stop saying my trauma makes me stronger. It actually is really hard to deal with. So that's coming up at 10:15. Let's do more Minnesota music right now. This is from Under Violet, a song called Billy.
Change. Well, I know I'm never gonna be Try to forget it 8,000 times.
There's something you may not understand. Ain't no problem if it's out your head. Oh. Get your head down.
the healing lips of a rising lion, and the breast of a mountain kissing the sky. You're a penny. Lashes like irises lining your eyes that arc with the weight of the reddening light. Crown and a dish, the seam of the lips, the petal and the stem.
Carson McComb on KAXE, The Canvas, from her September of last year release, Pentimento. I didn't quite hit that one right as it arrived, but caught it towards the end of last year and was really blown away. Kind of like an off-kilter alt-country album. There's lots of kind of weird stop-starts, time, signature switches, key changes, and doing a very interesting take on some more traditional country forms. McComb's been doing that now. I believe that's her fourth album out on Merge Records. Sam Henshaw, I have been bumping the heck out of that new Hair Down single. Just all good vibes around with the gospel-y backing vocals. What more could you want? And Minnesota's own Under Violet, we heard Billy from the Orchard album. Just about 15 minutes after 10 o'clock, you are listening to People Powered Radio KAXE. I'm your host, Malachi Koontz, and we'll be bringing you an interview with Mary Lucia in just a couple moments. Support for KEXE comes from our listener members and from the Itasca Unitarian Fellowship in Grand Rapids, a welcoming community for those engaged in the spiritual journey of life. All are welcome Sundays at 10 a.m. mid-September through mid-May. More at ItascaUnitarianFellowship.org or on Facebook. Support also comes from the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation, playing a vital role in connecting charitable intentions with community needs. Awarding $30 million in grants and scholarships over the past 30 years to make a lasting impact in our area. More information at gracf.org. Coming up today, your On the River host is Susan Lick from 1 to 4. That'd be a great hand-picked mix of folk rock, jazz, blues, and world music. Sarah Serra's hosting On the River tonight. That one is from 7 to 10. You can catch it every weekday at 1 early in the afternoon and at 7 in the evening. Also, looking ahead to some music towards the end of the week. The Smoking Desk are playing at the Blue Oyster in Brainerd, 7 p.m. on Thursday. And on Friday, there is Iromapalooza. That is the Iron Range Original Musicians Association. Lots of different folks from the range, like Rich Matson and the North Stars, Wild Child, Dave Rave and the Governors. I believe some bands from Duluth are coming over. It's at the Mako Theater in Virginia, 6 p.m. this Friday.
Mary Lucia has been a DJ in Minnesota for over 30 years, very well known for her time as the Drive Time DJ on The Current. She's released a memoir with one of the very best titles out there, What Doesn't Kill Me Makes Me Weirder and Harder to Relate To. Mary joins me now. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Mary.
Thank you, Kari. It really just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it?
It sticks in my brain, that's for sure. First off, I just want to start that this has been another traumatic week in Minnesota, particularly in the metro. How are you holding up?
You know, I'm really glad you asked that, because it would be impossible for me to not reveal and show how absolutely unnerved I feel. I don't think we've recovered since 2020 as a city, and we're so vulnerable right now. To have had this happen, again, within this proximity of similar neighborhood, and going to bed at night with the helicopters overhead, it's not cool. And you thought maybe that you would have learned something when George Floyd was murdered, that you wouldn't feel as helpless, but you do. You absolutely do. And when you stop and look at the whole thing unfold, you realize there is one version and another version. They're never going to cross, and you have to make sense of that. So, yeah, it's really disarming.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was my old neighborhood where I lived.
Yeah.
Also.
Oh, yeah.
And I have lots of friends still down there, and just touching base with all of them has been hard.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about this book here, Mary. And first, I want to kind of go back that you've been in the public eye and you've been on radio for most of your adult life. So let's start at the beginning. How did you get into radio?
I was living in New York. I was studying acting at NYU. And
is that what you thought you wanted to do, obviously?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I kind of did pursue it throughout even the last 30 years. But it was one of those things where, Kari, I had like the most wicked fake ID in the world. And all I wanted to do was go to shows. And I couldn't get any of my theater type friends interested in music. So I could already feel myself kind of peeling off in a different direction. And at that time I heard, oh, there's this station that's launching in Minneapolis, and it's sort of being spearheaded by this very cool DJ from First Avenue, Kevin Cole. And this was, of course, in the sort of birth of what they were calling alternative rock, 1994. I just cold called him. I mean, it's something I would never do today. I cold called him. I had no experience, and he took a chance, which is just, I don't know. I think you need to have somebody in your life at least once or twice that has that kind of renegade spirit that goes, I realize you have no experience, but based on just talking to you and the things I'm learning about you, I'll give you a chance. Mm-hmm. And it literally was like, all right, I'm leaving school. And I moved here in 94.
Wow.
Yeah.
Kevin is from Northern Minnesota. He's
originally, yes.
Yeah. And so I, side note, tried to get him to come work here a few years back.
Yeah. Give up.
Pipe
Give
dream,
up
come on.
Crime slap. Yeah. Oh, man.
So this memoir that you've just released covers a lot of ground about your life, but is centered around these 3 years where you had this listener who turned into a stalker while you were at The Current. What made you want to write about this experience?
A couple of things, I think. When I was going through it, I'm a really voracious, compulsive reader myself. And I somehow thought maybe I could find someone's book that's been through this, or I could again, it was trying to relate to someone or to be relatable. And I found there was just very little out there about stalking, and what was out there was mostly domestic stalking, in which you know the the stalker, like a former partner or landlord or something. So the circumstances as a person in media, as you well know, is these parasocial relationships develop. And if you're good at your job, then you're your authentic self on air. So people will feel that they know you. And to a large degree, they do. Of course, they don't know everything. But for the most part, I don't have a, you know, I don't have a second persona. It's just, this is me. So when people would say, I've listened to you for years and I feel like I know you, it wasn't a scary thing at the time. I was like, yeah, you could kind of do. And I think from the very beginning of radio, I've had, I don't know, for lack of any better word, just, you know, weirdos or people that felt boundaryless, of course. You know when it's moved into a different realm of just, oh, that person's maybe just an overly zealous fan to somebody wanting to do you harm. And it isn't hard to decipher the threat.
Mm-hmm. So the stalker sent you packages at work, which is where it started, and which mm-hmm. moved into threatening yours and your dog's safety, eventually finding your own personal phone number and address, dropping packages off at all hours of the day, which obviously triggers an immediate feeling of violation, and obviously led, as you kind of talk in the book, to a maybe, I don't know if paranoia is the right word, but isolation. And how have you unraveled that since?
You know, I would love to say that that 9 years later, that it's so far in my rear view, but I'll give you an example. This summer, after like a big storm, all of a sudden the insurance adjusters come out of the woodwork and they start knocking on your door, seeing if you have hail damage on your roof. And one day this guy came by and said, I could get up on your roof and see if you have hail damage. And I was even reticent about that, but I thought, okay, what the hell? And he went up and, you know, I thanked him. He left. It was a Monday afternoon. And Tuesday night, I was standing in the backyard the next day in the evening with my dogs and noticed that my side gate was wide open. And my reaction was just cry. And I know that is not a normal reaction to an open gate. And it did sort of show me, no, you know, when people say, I'm so glad that's over for you. And, you know, it doesn't take a ton, but it was something that was a horrible trigger because that was so much a part of the violation of when he was coming into my yard, and I have a privacy fence with locks and all that. So it, just to see an open gate, I don't think should elicit tears, but that was just last summer. So
your brain went right back there.
Right back there.
Yeah. As a reader, there are so many various points throughout the book that bring out frustration for you in this process. You were gaslit by a lot of different entities, from victim blaming and shaming to like a lack of urgency in handling and then understanding how messed up this was and how deep it went for you as where, you know, how it affected you. Let's start with your former employer, particularly a manager, and just the egregious missteps in handling this situation. In looking at this now, 9 years later, there are obvious things they could have done better. But with some time, what are some other things that you've kind of thought about?
I will tell you that I was the first person to always say, I realize you can't possibly know what this feels like if this has not happened to you or someone you love. So I cut a ton of slack for people's lack of understanding, but their lack of interest in knowing what it was doing to me is where things just went off the rail for me, because they really wanted a business as usual model. And I was absolutely not the same person mm-hmm. at the time. Yet they wanted and expected me to shake it off, come back in and do my job as I had. And I think that had there been a modicum amount of willingness to understand, it would have gone so far. It's funny to think that even in 9 years, I mean, at that time, you know, everyone has a Ring camera now. But at that time, every time I was calling the police after he'd been to my house, they kept saying, you've got to get your employer to get a security camera, like a 7-Eleven camera at your house. It was a big ordeal. And it was just met with this resistance and like the, you were kind of doing you some special favor. And again, I've said this because I really stand by this. And that is, you know, my intentions are never to, I'm going to just drag someone's shortcomings through the public eye. I honestly feel as though these were the people that were in my life that I worked for, that I worked with. And if they had been different people, I would have written about them.
Mm-hmm. I don't even understand. This week is I've been on the air and just mm-hmm. with everything going on, and I've been on the air many times when the world is heavy or things happen. And that requires a lot of mental gymnastics to get to a place that feels sort of normal or feel real to a listener without going too much into it, trying to toe that line of meeting them where they are, also giving them a reprieve. I can't imagine you were on the air throughout all of this, aside from mm-hmm. that leave that you took when the court case was coming. I cannot imagine how mentally exhausting that must have been for you.
It changed it before the stalking. I didn't give a ton of thought before I cracked the mic. I was a lot more spontaneous and free and didn't question everything I was doing. And you know as well, it's like when you're promoting things for a radio station, you'll say something like, I'll be at the show tomorrow night and I hope to see you there, it'll be great. Well, I just had to eliminate all of that, and it just became about, there's a mentally unstable listener out there who is parceling everything I say and believes that I'm talking to them specifically through coded messages and song choices. It really made me stop, think, what am I doing? Is this going to elicit more junk? Which is really hard. And then it was kind of like when I kind of got some footing back, it happened to a coworker, same guy. And again, hooray, we're reopening that trauma box, but in a different way, but nonetheless, pointing the shortcomings out of our legal system, mm-hmm. how courts view stalking, which is a felony crime. And yet, if there is mental illness involved, which usually I think there is, it's impossible. Courts can't mandate mental health help. And the most frustrating part is without physical proof of damage, either a gunshot, a stab wound, they don't see the damage. And so the only time they know, well, we could maybe lock them up for the criminally insane, but they would have had to have inflicted an act of violence against you. And you're sitting there in court going, the violence is here. It's here. I'm grateful there isn't a bullet hole, but it's really messed up. And I just hoped even writing this book in some way would at least shine a light on, again, the kind of trauma when somebody is telling you that they know where you are every second and every minute, and you start to believe it, of course, and what it takes away from you, that damage is really hard to explain to a judge.
You wrote in there that by the time he was sentenced, they let him go on good behavior. I mean, he was already basically out.
He walked out the same day I did. And it was so unnerving because, again, there was nothing throughout the period of his stalking me that would have ever indicated that he had limits to how far he would go. It was very clear that no consequence seemed to frighten him in terms of possible jail time, arrest, restraining orders. I mean, when a person shows disregard for all, then you really believe they're capable of absolutely anything.
You've said the phrase in some form or another that the trauma was as real to me as the delusion was to him. And I find that to be a really powerful statement about that mental capacity.
There is a part. Yeah, there is. There's a part of me that is. I mean, I am. I'm human, and I am absolutely empathetic towards mental illness, of course. And I kind of decided that throughout those 3 years, it was, again, it doesn't make anything better or rest easier. But yeah, the delusion clearly was just as real to him as all of this trauma was to me. And so again, it's a felony, but you know what to do if somebody's selling drugs. But if somebody is, you know, writing explicit, horrible letters and dropping absolutely insane things, a pile of black dirt on your front step with a sympathy card stuck in the top, you know, your mind starts thinking, how did this person even do this? I can't even get my head around the mechanical. Did he walk up with a pile of, I mean, it's crazy. And the other thing was, when I was trying to explain what was happening and what this person was doing, so many people's response, the first words out of their mouth were, who in their right mind would, and I'd go,
stop you there.
Stop.
Yeah.
It's not someone in their right mind. You have to think differently, which I had to do.
Yeah. You mentioned that your coworker ended up being stalked by the very same man. What was your immediate reaction upon finding that out? Like, what place did you go?
Anger.
Yeah.
Anger. And I hadn't really tapped into the anger. In fact, I felt so powerless during the ordeal of 3 years up until, you know, the sentencing of him walking out the door behind me. I then learned that he was renting an apartment less than two blocks from where I live. And, you know, anger is an energy. Thank you, John Lydon. It is. And I tapped into something that got a little on the vigilante side. But when I learned it was happening again to a coworker and with the same person, and I just knew what this person was about to experience, I got really angry. And it was the only thing that made me feel just a little more in control.
Throughout all of this, I mean, there were some of your family responded in not a great way. The police, there was a real disconnect there, which you've, you know, kind of talked about with that physical harm. Were there points during this process that you felt like you were losing it? Like you were kind of going crazy?
Yeah. I mean, I'd half joke, but I mean, you know, I thought, nothing works. Okay, get your head around that. Nothing works and no one can help you was basically what I was left thinking. And then at some point I thought, I think I gotta move. It was like, there was a real sense of just knee jerk, like I just have to get out of this place that this keeps happening. And then of course I thought about that and thought, that's insanity. If I move, this person likely, if I stayed in this Minnesota, they would find me. And it was, you know, a lot of those things weren't rational thinking on my part. And did I think I was losing my mind? Yes. And physically. And it was like, oh, you have shingles. And it was like, just, you know, it was like, this is nothing I would wish on your worst enemy.
Yeah. Why did you stay in Minnesota?
This is KAXE People Power Radio. Right now we have more for you from Kari Hedlund's interview with Mary Lucia.
About all of this, I mean, there were some of your family responded in a not a great way. The police, there was a real disconnect there, which you've, you know, kind of talked about with that physical harm. Were there points of during this process that you felt like you were losing it? Like you were kind of going crazy?
Yeah. I mean, I'd half joke, but I mean, you know, I thought nothing works. Okay. Get your head around that. Nothing works and no one can help you was basically what I was left thinking. And then at some point I thought, I think I got to move. It was like, there was a real sense of just knee jerk, like I just have to get out of this place that this keeps happening. And then of course I thought about that and thought that's insanity. If I move, this person likely, if I stayed in this Minnesota, they would find me. And it was, you know, a lot of those things weren't rational thinking on my part. And did I think I was losing my mind? Yes. And physically, and it was like, oh, you have shingles. And it was like, just, you know, it was like, this is nothing I would wish on your worst enemy.
Yeah. Why did you stay in Minnesota? You kind of talk about the trying other cities on for size during
this. I did. I for some reason, like, narrowed down about four. And, you know, I think there was always, because I had lived in New York and I'd lived in Boston for a while, and I somehow, in my head, I thought, let's see, Austin, Texas, Seattle, Memphis, and maybe Boston was back on the map. But, you know, radio jobs also don't grow on trees. And, you know, I really feel as though what I was doing here in this specific market was a career. It wasn't a job. It was my career. I had built my reputation and name on a really pretty solid work ethic. I really truly felt as though I had earned what I had gotten. It was my currency, if you will. And at The Current, I did sort of feel like a brand ambassador to a large degree. And so there certainly was a part of me that thought, I have to give that up for a stranger.
Mm-hmm. So this is your first book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But your writing style is so nailed down. It's funny. It's horrifying. It's totally rock and roll. Does does writing come easy to you, or is it a struggle?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, writing has always been easy. And you know, I got to tell you, and I think I wrote about it, I had a teacher in a writing class, and the way that she would grade the papers and hand them back out was in a row, everybody passed the paper behind them of the student behind them. And in my papers, I could see my paper before it ever got to me, because this woman had written with blood, for all I know, like red ink, AWK, A-W-K, was in every margin, short for awkward. And I was embarrassed. And I remember I got the nerve up to go up to her after class. And I said, I just think maybe I need some clarification. Is this grammatically awkward? Which I would believe. And she said, no, you write in the same way you talk.
That's what I love about it.
Well, of course. I was literally at that age, I was thinking, see ya at my book launch,
yeah.
You cow. You know, it was like, wow, what a weird thing to say to a creative to say, no, there's a definitive line of how to do something and you are doing it wrong. And it's always made me laugh. Awk. So, but yeah, I've written you know, columns, and always had a finite amount of space. And I also think that translated a little bit into how I approached radio, which was get in, get out. Like if I didn't have anything interesting to say, it was just like, keep moving. And so it definitely was, it is still something that luckily comes pretty easily to me. And if you like my speaking voice and my personality, then I think you can safely say that you'd like my book, my writing.
Yeah. So you have written about this experience. In doing so, you know, you're kind of going back there. You've released the book, you're talking about it now. Are you getting to a point, or maybe you're already there, where you're so over talking about it? Has it been therapeutic? Is it kind of all the things?
You know, I'm not tired of talking about it because everyone seems to kind of hone in on a different part of it. And it hasn't really been a consistency of the same questions. It really has been. Some people are more sparked by the legal process. Some people are far more sparked by the humor, which is great. It has not gotten tiresome at all. In fact, it's been kind of a pleasure because it's one thing to kind of live in the public eye to a certain degree, but this is me in a way that people really haven't seen me before. And I think I knew when I wrote this book that I would have to stand behind everything I wrote about it myself. I think that throughout the last month or so of doing readings and Q&As and things, I've only had one moment that was like a real like clonk, just fell to the floor. And if that's all I've had, then I'm pretty lucky, I think.
So you're back on the air on Radio K, and mm-hmm. it's the college station at the U of M. In the book, you mentioned that you foolishly still believe music programming can be an art form, which, as you and I both know, is very much not the case in the vast majority of radio stations, even stations that we know and love. Mm-hmm. We still have that ethos at KAXE. We get to pick every single thing that we play. I would assume Radio K is the same.
Mm-hmm.
How has it been getting back into that creative art form?
Well, you know, it's sometimes I have to sort of rein in my ghoulish, dark view of radio because these are young people that are excited. But I will tell you that when I first walked in, when I first got the job 2 years ago, and I just said, hey, just a show of hands, how many of you are thinking about pursuing radio broadcast after school? Not one hand went up. And I thought, well, that's probably smart. But then I thought, well, then what the hell am I doing here? I was like, well, okay. Well, then it sort of turned my job into college radio, and very few exceptions, of freedom and music choices and personality being rewarded. It's a dying art form. It's certainly not available in commercial radio. And to some degree, even public radio has really moved away from personality-driven radio. So I just say, you know, at the bare minimum, radio should be fun. And this is the perfect time to have that fun because, yeah, and then I have to stop myself from saying, because in the real world, if you wanted to be in radio, you're going to get beaten down, you know. But so it is nice to see sort of just really raw enthusiasm for new music, old music, discovery, without the confines of all the, like, I think it was Dennis Rodman who said, you know, I'd play basketball for free. It's the BS you got to pay me for. So it's kind of true.
How has it been being back on the air? Was that a journey for you to get back to a place that felt right and felt authentic?
You know, I got to tell you, I mean, so everybody at Radio K has a DJ name, and, you know, I thought, okay, I'll play. So, I said, well, I'll do a show and I'll be DJ Lucifer. And then I just thought, you know, I'm not even going to really like tell a lot of people. It might just be funny if somebody is flipping around and they hear it, which is kind of what's happened, because I'm certainly not trying to pull any focus from them. But it's kind of funny to just pop in, you know, and play Dean Martin. And if somebody's listening carefully enough, I think sometimes you can identify that it's me on air by the music that I'm playing before you ever hear my voice.
Well, thank you so much, Mary, for your time today, for your book. It was such a great read, and as someone in radio and, you know, in a regional public eye, I mm-hmm. found it to be extraordinarily informative about how to possibly support someone, and maybe better what not to do if, you know, one of my colleagues has this situation. I just, I feel like anyone who has any sort of job where they are in the public eye in any realm, that was a very enlightening read for me on how to navigate possible future issues, you know?
I think that if within media, there's probably a hierarchy where it's like television, radio, print. And I think every one of those categories gets crazy messages and threatening, oddball, weird things. But I really think that to advocate for yourself is a big message, because truly you cannot rely on someone else doing it for you. If I may ask you, well, you've said such nice things. How did you feel while you were reading it? I'm just curious.
I felt quite unnerved. Being in this job, there have been certainly instances or messages or comments that are a little unsettling. Hasn't gone any further than that. You know, invitations to people's to go travel with someone that I don't know, to go to a concert, or, you know, those kinds of things where it's done from their perspective most of the time, I think, with good intent. So it was a little unsettling to read because I could so easily see how this is could become a reality. So I would say it was a bit unsettling. It was, as I said, extraordinarily frustrating for you on so many levels, particularly within the legal system, within the lack of accountability within this. But also, you made me laugh so much. I loved your stories about your family, you know, your growing up, and you're so real and raw. And in spite of the frustration and the unsettling, it was a really enjoyable read.
Oh, that means everything.
Which is a really hard balance, I think. So
it kind of is. I mean, I don't think anyone wants to pick up like 280 pages of trauma. You know, it's like, let's break it up. Let's break it up with some other things. But that is a really nice thing to hear, especially from someone in radio.
Good. And I'm dying to know that Prince story, but I won't push you because I know you said you won't tell it.
Never tell.
And Andrea didn't get it out of you at the meeting?
Andrea doesn't even know it. Oh, so, okay. There's one person who knows it.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Mary Lucia's book, What Doesn't Kill Me Makes Me Weirder and Harder to Relate To, is out now.
You will be able to find that conversation if you want to revisit any of that. Kari Hedlund chatting with Mary Lucia about her book at kaxe.org. Follow us on social media as well to know when that'll be up for you to check it out. This is KAXE. I'm Malachi Coons. You are listening to Headwaters every weekday from 9 to 11, again at 10 p.m. Your source for great music and great interviews as well. We receive support from FrameUp in downtown Grand Rapids, committed to displaying treasured goods for over 40 years, offering prints, posters, and beyond. More at frameup.com. And from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org.
One still stinging back on my mind. I feel that phone ringing, and there is no way back from this. Everything hits at once. What we need is just what we want.
Everything hits at once. That is Spoon, taking us towards the end of Headwaters today. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Malachi Coons. Coming up in just a few moments, it is the World Cafe. There is a cold weather advisory in effect until noon today. Wind chills 25 to 40 below. Increasing clouds throughout the day. We've got highs in the single digits, anywhere from 2 to 10 around the area. Tonight, lows negative 6 to 2 above. Tomorrow, a little bit warmer, cloudy, chance of snow, highs 11 to 19. Thursday, back down to much colder, daytime highs negative 9 to 0 around the area. That is making up new words for how cold it is. Evening lows, negative 26 to negative 33 for Thursday. So, very chilly on the way. We'll keep you posted about more cold weather advisories around the area. Right now, we are up to negative 1 in Grand Rapids, up to negative 4 in Bemidji, and we do have sunny skies still across the region. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, at 89.9 in Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from KD Floral, located on 4th and Minnesota in downtown Bemidji, offering floral arrangements for all occasions, indoor plants, curated gifts, and space to express your creative side. KDFloral.com on Facebook and Instagram. And our question of the week, what are your favorite ways to spend time outside during the winter? Text in to 218-326-1234. And very fitting this week. Definitely need some questions. Should be getting some warm weather gear for this week. But for me, I've always liked to snowshoe. Been getting into skiing this year, and I've been told that I'm not just uncoordinated. It's actually an icy year. So that's what I'm going with for how cross-country skiing is going for me so far. Susan Link will be your On the River host today from 1 to 4.